Okay, now we start.
As we said a few seconds ago, Japan was completely occupied by the United States, did not share occupation with Britain or Russia. Germany was divided, as we talked about earlier, into occupation zones and eventually into a West and East Germany. Similarly speaking, Korea was treated the same way after World War II. And in 1945, the Soviets, by de facto, occupied the northern area. In fact, let's talk a little bit about Soviets' involvement in the war. Because as you recall, the Soviets were neutral with Japan throughout almost all of World War II, right? There were two nations that were not at war with each other. And in the final 3 days of the war, which would be, what, 7th, 8th, and 9th, August 7th, 8th, and 9th, Russia declares war on Japan. Why did they do so? I mean, well, there's a couple of reasons.
Land.
Well, yes, but well, why? Officially, why were they supposed to do so?
Because 3 months after the fall of Germany.
As they promised where?
Yeah, Potsdam.
Yalta. Reaffirmed Potsdam, but they promised at Yalta. So they were supposed to come in out of obligation. By the time they were coming in, we really didn't want or need them in because we had the bomb, we hoped we could finish it early. So in addition to honoring commitments, they also had some of their own self-interests involved, in which are what?
The taking back the Japanese gains during the Russo-Japanese War.
Yes, that's exactly it. The southern half of the Sakhalin Island, which is there anywhere in the world that's moving? Yeah. Southern half of the Sakhalin Island would go back to Russian control. And they wanted to have influence in Manchuria, just kind of in some ways goes all the way back to the Russo-Japanese War also. But another feature is, what civil war is going to resume in China following World War II?
Communist
versus nationalist. The Chiang Kai-shek versus Mao Zedong forces. And the Russians definitely want to see the communists and Mao Zedong win. So by moving into northeast Manchuria and China in the closing days, they can disarm, capture Japanese, and turn those weapons over to Mao's forces. So, and then they also move into northern Korea. So when they move into northern Korea after 1945, what's the American attitude about their presence there?
They're going to start spreading communism.
Yeah, that they really don't belong here. They didn't deserve it. That they did none of the fighting, and now they're trying to share an occupation zone. And we had the southern portion. By 1948, it was firmly defined at this line, the West.
Are the stands in existence still
Are Soviet republics from 1917 till 1990. They are Soviet republics, part of the USSR.
But then in 89 they become their own country.
Right.
Do they have like basically the
90,
same
actually.
Borders that they had when they were?
Pretty much the same borders. That's one of the great amazing stories of world history, is that how all those Soviet republics were able to gain independence without a gigantic civil war being forcing them to stay. Like, Gorbachev could have pulled the Lincoln and said, no one's leaving. Do we praise him for not?
Yeah.
Why did he not? Why didn't he keep the Union together?
Because
they were in a
huge mess. Let that happen.
I think it's a case of that it became even clear to the Soviets that these countries did not ever really want to be part of the Soviet Empire, that they were just forced into it. So this line separated the two Koreas. What is the line?
30th parallel.
And what line separated the two Vietnams?
That one.
Which is what number parallel?
Yeah.
17th?
Yeah.
And what line separated Canada from Washington after the... 49th. This is the three historic parallels you got to remember. Is this one? 38? Yeah. And the northern section of Korea was trained to be an ally of the Russians, and after 1950, of the Chinese, as they turned communist in 1950. And the southern was raised and trained and tutelage, so to speak, under the U.S. pressures. And we'll see more of this in 1950 coming up. But first, we've got to do the 1940 election on 127. You may be wondering, why did I put that 126 in there? I think it must have cut. In the textbook I originally built, the lecture probably came in that order. Domestic politics. Could Truman have run for president again in 48?
Yep.
That's according to what do we believe here. Could he have run again in 52?
Yep.
Okay, we're on the same page then.
Oh, no, he couldn't have.
Sorry.
Say yes.
Oh my God. In 48 he could and did.
When did that? Not 45. one term, two terms. Yeah, he couldn't run again in 52.
Anywho?
Yeah. Is this the Gangs of New York endless argument here?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, Gangs of New York. Don't have to do that. That's
really
good.
You really good shot. Should have thought.
Okay. Truman is president. Truman has not had a good, easy presidency following the... You would think after winning World War II on your birthday, at least the European part of it, that Truman was going to have a pretty well, you know, smooth post-war period. But the times that Truman served involved Cold War, tensions and fears of the Cold War. It also involved a steel strike, which he did have to use the Taft-Hartley Act, a measure he didn't want the power to use, to call a delay to the steel strike. So both domestic and economic situations were not as good as people would have wished. I think they probably as good as they could have been for a post-war period. But politically, it didn't look like Truman could win re-election in 1948. And many in the party tried to convince him that it would be to the party's advantage to have a new, fresh candidate because he can only lose. But Truman demanded that he still be the candidate. And sitting, yes?
What was the steel strike? Did you give a name for that?
I didn't. I don't know much more than what I just said.
It's not important on the
thing? It's important in the sense that it contributed to the climate of not being a popular president. Okay. Labor was pissed at him for using the Taft-Hartley Act against them. And so we'd reached the point where if a sitting president wanted to be the candidate again, there was enough power in the party to get away with it, so he could against his party's own wishes. And my understanding is that the party already kind of wrote him off as a loser right then and there, and so they contacted the Republicans and said, since we can't win this election anyway, where are you holding your convention? I said, Philadelphia. Well, can we just rent the hall after you use it so we can save on costs? And then the Republicans said, we understand your plight. Yes, we'll go with that.
A Democrat did this? Right. Why are they being a money conscious?
Because they want to win 52. They're already going to have to spend a lot losing 48.
Okay.
It's kind of like the way Democrats thought about 1984. What's the parallel I'm making? You can't beat Reagan. He's going to win re-election no matter what.
So just hoard up a lot of money for the next
one. Yeah, go ahead and let Mondale be the candidate because he's an old party hack and he's associated with Carter. And while we're losing, let's make a first by having...
You're going to be five of the essays on the government that will be Reagan Mondale.
What other first did the 1984 female vice presidential candidate? So even though we can't win, we can historically be first.
Politics.
But Truman surprised people. He went around telling a lot of people, you know, I'm going to win this thing, and if you want to be on the gravy train, you better from the beginning have been with me rather than at the end jumping on. To make it extra hard for Truman to win, there were breakaway third-party candidacies. Henry Wallace. Where do we know him from? His father was by the same name. Henry A. Wallace Sr. was the agricultural secretary for Harding. This is the junior who served as agricultural secretary for FDR in the 30s.
Anti-segregation throughout the South.
The father had fought for McNary Hagen. He had fought for and achieved the AAA during the 30s. He was very left of center. When, you remember who John Nance Garner was? Cactus Jack. He was the vice president twice for FDR, but then equated the office with the pitcher of worms fit and wouldn't run for a third term. Mm-hmm. Wallace became the third term vice president for FDR. When they wanted FDR to run for a fourth term in 44, they said Wallace has shown himself to be so left-wing that in the post-war period dealing with Stalin and the Russians, you know, I don't think we can gather the votes if he becomes, because they kind of realized he could die and get to become president. So they said, we want to kick him off the ticket, and you got to tell him. So FDR said that story to Wallace about how in the post-war period, economic recovery, not slipping back into the Depression, will be critical, and we need a commerce secretary who can carry us through, and you can't do that as vice president. Would you be willing to leave the vice presidency and be commerce secretary? And Wallace knew he was being demoted. And Truman got his place because Truman had... done the cost overruns of the Army Committee spending bills in the Senate. So when, FDR dies, Truman becomes president, and here is Wallace, who should have been president, serving as Secretary of Commerce for Truman. And there was understandable resentment there between the two. And eventually they disagreed on foreign policy. Wallace thought that we were way overboard on our hawkish attitudes towards the Russians, that we should be treating these people as post-war allies, and that if we were real close and cooperative, we wouldn't have problems in Greece and Turkey and Berlin and the Far East. We could get along better. But Truman was determined to take over harsh, hawkish anti-Soviet policy, so as they clashed and argued, eventually Wallace quit and resigned. In the 48 election, Wallace decides to run as a third-party candidate, primarily to show how wrong Truman's foreign policy is. So he's trying to wreck the presidency rather than get elected. But you're right, he was the one that was one of the first candidates to campaign for racial equality and civil rights measures. In fact, some of the civil rights measures that we'll talk about Truman doing or seeking is because of the urgings of Wallace's candidacy, which is in this one. In fact, let's go to that right now because it'll make Strom Thurmond make more sense. If you can make Thurmond make any sense. But in 1948, Truman wanted to follow up on the New Deal with his own package of domestic reforms called the Fair Deal. Well, the country just wasn't in the same mood for domestic reform as they had been in the 30s. It could be parallel to this, that America was for progressive reform up to World War I, and World War I killed off the enthusiasm for reform. The New Deal was popular until World War II, but that kind of killed off. So in the post-war period, people are not into more reform. But Truman wanted to pursue it by proposing Fair Deal measures. They included, and it's more than I can remember, but I know that comes to mind, is federal housing, low-cost housing for people.
HUD?
That's eventually what it comes to in the 60s. National health insurance, universal health care for all. When did that happen?
Never. Well, Medicare, but...
Never. Not universal, you know. Not yet, we'll say. And civil rights measures. And that's that third one. There was something else besides national health insurance, low-cost federal housing, civil rights measures. I think it was like full paid for education costs, something in there. But you've seen the Fair Deal measures. But the civil rights plank was the one that bothered Southern Democrats the most. Southern Democrats, back this up and say, why had FDR... And I don't think he was really a hardcore racist. I think he was kind of unenthused and not sympathetic, but he wasn't a hardcore racist against black people. Why was FDR, with all his measures of the New Deal, unwilling to pursue anything about civil rights? Especially after black voters came in mass numbers in 36 to join the party.
But he wasn't part of it.
What was the question?
I couldn't get people to...
He didn't want to piss off the Southerners.
It's not time for the abolishing of slavery.
That's not what I meant.
These slaves don't need to be free yet. It's not...
They don't want to isolate...
Maybe FDR and his genius realized that, that you just can't get that done.
That's what it was. Right. That's the right now. Why couldn't you get it done?
Because of Southern Democrats.
And you don't need a division.
Not only because of Southern Democrats, it's this. How do you get seniority on committee chairpersonships? I mean, how do you get chairpersonship?
Seniority.
And how do you get seniority?
By being there a very long time.
Southern Democrats were there longer than anybody else. Why? Because they don't run against any Republicans.
They don't run against anyone.
Yeah, once you get elected, you just never lose re-election. You just stay forever. So Southern Democrats always had the most lengthy time. And if Democrats dominated Congress, Southern Democrats dominated chairpersonships. So you didn't get any bills passed, New Deal bills or anything else, if you... PO'd Southern Democrats. So if you go starting to seek civil rights for African Americans, you're going to get nowhere with it. And that's why FDR knew he couldn't pursue it, because he just didn't have the leadership in Congress to do it. But Truman was, and it's to his Truman's credit, thinking that it was such a time has come post-World War II a necessity, he desegregated the military by presidential order, that he wanted to see that in his Fair Deal package. And it wasn't going anywhere because of that. In addition to that, Republicans, I believe, had gained a majority in one or both, in one of the houses in 48. So in the middle of the summer, he proposes this plan that is special sessions of Congress, which I think he's the last president to ever do this. The president is authorized to call emergency sessions of Congress when they're out. And he did in the summer to consider the Fair Deal measures. And in doing that helped aggravate and worsen Strom Thurmond's thinking about the party, because Thurmond's from where?
The South.
South Carolina.
Oh, God. Everyone bad from the South is from South Carolina.
Except for the bad people from New York.
Except for who?
Jefferson Davis.
Are you kidding? He's born in Mississippi, lives in South Carolina. Something like that.
Did you say he moved and then was corrupted by South Carolina?
Teach all this?
What did you say?
We live in South Carolina. High schools teach it.
We live in the South.
We do, but
so we're kind
of. Yeah, how do we? Well, they, we they're over there saying, I wonder how they teach Central High. Which, and since we're deviating for a second, I'm going to deviate with this story. 1996, Elton John and Billy Joel did a group tour together. They did a lot of those, but they did it. And they came to Little Rock to play War Memorial Stadium. And one of Billy Joel's songs is We Didn't Start the Fire.
Oh, that's
so. And you know the lyrics that are what? What's going on there?
It's like history.
This yeah, name's always
it's all the 50s.
And named Central High.
Yeah, he names one event after another in a hurry in the 50s. And one of the events he names is Central High. Little Rock, because it's Little Rock comes into the story. We know when performers are visiting a city and say they have a song in which they normally have Winslow, Arizona in the lyrics, that they'll change it to L.A., make everybody happy that their city was in the song lyrics. He's singing along, and when he gets to Little Rock, everybody cheered.
Did they listen to any of the other parts in that one?
Well, you have to wonder, was it just by accident, or, yeah, we're racist, right on!
Maybe they were cheering that.
I was going to say, yeah.
Maybe like,
Eisenhower.
I don't know.
Because the schools are integrated.
They were cheering Eisenhower for sitting in the parish.
I think so. So how does South Carolina teach?
They're cheering that their parents were idiots, but they're not because they're at that concert.
So do South Carolina schools cheer in their classes that they no longer believe in nullification?
Or Fort Sumter, or Strom Thurmond, or...
Strom Thurmond. He was a governor of South Carolina in his 40s at this time period. And
he was only in his hundreds when he died. Yeah, and he's still in the Senate.
Very, very frustrated at the proposal, even the thought of civil rights measures. By the way, let me go back and talk a little bit about this special session. It met. It voted on nothing. And Truman said, this is why you should reelect me. Because you should not only reelect me, you should reelect more Democrats to Congress because the so-called do-nothing 80 of Congress didn't act on what you need in the fair deal, so we're like me and more Democrats.
So do they count as a separate Congress if you convene a special session like that?
Truman's what party?
Democrat. And so is Thurmond and so is Wallace. So Thurmond decides to run as a third party candidate under a party name called the Dixiecrats, or more formally, the States Rights Democrats. And their main reason for running...
Is it right as in the right to slavery?
When you hear states' rights, that's always a code word for states defying federal authority, usually on something liberal like a civil rights measure. So states' rights Democrats are Dixiecrat, and there is in here somewhere a picture that always gets...
Watch them try to blow up from Iraq, and South Carolina nullifies and keeps their National Guard there.
Wait till I can find this. You'll
get it.
You
can't
really say in the world.
South Carolina's head coach of the college team that went out against the Confederate flag flying and got them.
Really?
Yeah.
What?
The new one?
The one, the famous Spurrier.
What
are
you saying?
He says he doesn't agree.
Want to see a picture of the Dixiecrat convention? Check this out. This ought to be a document. The DBQ question, this should be the document.
Is this the Dixiecrat Convention or the Klan Convention?
Dixiecrat.
Oh, my God.
Arkansas. Right?
Yeah. The Confederate flags, pictures of Robert E. Lee.
And then it says Arkansas.
God.
So now that you get the emotional feeling of that picture, let me tell a little present-day story. Thurmond, of course, obviously didn't win the election.
You should put that photo.
No, what your mom says you should.
Thurmond would also, in 1955, after being elected to the Senate, give the longest filibuster in Senate history, 22 hours and 15 minutes. Anybody else? And this guy, Strom Thurmond, J. Strom Thurmond. The Dixie
that was just him?
He himself gave the 22 hour and 15 minutes filibuster speech against civil rights, again, to the state rights. So you can, could you stand or at least speak for a full day without food, water, whatever it is they have to go without?
Apparently he could.
On any issue?
They have water on the podium.
Okay, without food. Without bathroom break.
I thought they could take a...
They probably can.
Bathroom break.
But I'm trying to make the story dramatic.
Okay.
In other words, would you do that on something as abstract as states' rights?
Yeah.
Or would it be...
Well, not a racist thing.
There you go.
Didn't they, like, read out the Sears and Roebuck catalog?
So, I mean, how badly do you have to dislike someone of an opposite race to speak that long?
You have to be raised without belief.
Well, in the early 60s, as we know, many, many Democrats left the party in the South once the party became truly a civil rights-oriented party and joined the Republicans. Not to say Republicans are prejudiced. I'm not saying that. They're just mad at being the Democratic Party being too liberal. And as years unfolded, Strom Thurmond said he dropped those views and hired black people to work for him. But the image of him being one of the lead segregationists ever hung over him throughout the rest of his life as he continued to be reelected to the Senate all the way until when, 2000?
He was reelected until he died.
That's what I thought, in 2000. So in around 2000, when was Trent Lott's little mishap?
Like 2005 or 2004.
Somewhere around
2000.
Yeah, we wouldn't have all these problems.
At 101 years old, in his wheelchair, celebrating his birthday. Oh, he looked bad, too. Trent Lott came over to him and patted him on the back, wished him happy birthday, and said, you know, if you'd won that election, we wouldn't have had all these problems.
He was crucified for that.
And Trent Lott, Senate Majority Leader, was no longer Senate Majority Leader.
Now
even
he's a Senate Minority Whip.
For forgiveness on BET like Don Irons.
Now he's a Minority Whip in the Senate.
Minority Whip. What problems was he speaking of?
Equality.
I guess so. So Wallace, as a super left-wing liberal progressive, that was his title, why Wallace was a progressive party, third-party candidate. Thurmond, as a Dixiecrat or states' rights Democrat, both Democrats, so most of your liberal Democrats are following away from Truman. Your southern element seemingly will leave Truman and take off. I mean, the Republicans see this as the easiest slam dunk coming, and who are they going to run?
Dewey.
John Dewey, who had run in 44 the last time against FDR.
And somehow lose.
And he had done well. He had done better against FDR than anybody else did. So it was really showing that the...
Why does it say Tom Dewey? Yeah, what was his first name?
Tom Dewey.
You said
Tom?
John.
Never trust me. Tom Dewey. I get Melville John, not Tom, and George. They're all mixed up there.
They're all the same.
It is Tom Dewey, right?
And is this one of those elections where people just sit there, scratch their head, and wonder, how could Dewey screw this up?
Well, the Republican Party even stopped campaigning. In fact, spent most of the time interviewing prospective cabinet members, which is not technically legal, so they were kind of just hinting around. But they figured they had it won. It was Truman couldn't pull it out at all, and it looked impossible. Truman was the only one that really believed he could make it. He hired a train, traveled around the country kind of Woodrow Wilson whistle style to campaign.
Without
a couple
of
times the train had to stop and wouldn't move further because the conductor said, until we get paid, we're not moving any further, and the party wouldn't allocate money to the... He had to go around and take donations from people who could get the train conductor paid to keep the train moving. There was one story about Truman was griping with the party on the phone and said, if this was FDR, they cut him off, you ain't FDR. But he still kept campaigning, and Alamogordo's, New Mexico... Somebody yelled out, give him hell, Harry, and his response was, I don't give him hell, I just tell the truth, and it sounds like hell. So somewhere in the end of the campaign, the radio coverage and the newspaper coverage of the camp started to cause people to really be impressed with his feisty spirit, that he wasn't willing to give up. But most people still believed he couldn't win, and in fact, the Chicago Daily Tribune...
Oh, yeah, they print, do he win?
Mm-hmm.
You've got to get the Onion article.
The back of the Onion book?
Where is the Onion book?
The textbook?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I think Jeremy stole it. Jeremy's doing it wrong.
Here's this one, where it says Dewey defeats Truman. That's the Chicago Tribune.
Is it in your blue?
Isn't this Chicago Tribune?
No, it should be under all
isn't
the
that, is that one
WGN. World's Greatest Newspaper.
That's supposed to be like really good. Something
like that.
Is it in this bag? The blue.
Maybe it's in the blue bag.
It's empty.
It's under your stack of stuff. Right
there. Let's go coordinates.
There's the textbook.
Okay.
Oh,
what's
that?
It's
on the back.
It's on the back, yeah.
Oh, it is?
Should we start the lesson?
Well, it's only got the picture.
What?
I hate you, Mr. Jones.
Is it running or not? Can you tell without stopping it? I can't tell.
Of the garden piece, what's
you.
His face?
It is running, and it's been running for 24 minutes, 35 seconds.
Other guy defeats what's his day.
Where's the?
So Truman got quite a kick out of the fact the next day when he woke up and discovered that unlike what the newspapers and everybody believed, he had won the election. And so that's that great upset. And In that election, I think it was the most of the, who did the poll? Gallup does polling, and who else does? Gallup and somebody else.
Gallup
Roper?
What?
Roper and Gallup are the two main polling services. They had both missed it by huge numbers. They predicted doing it, were totally wrong. And they really readjusted their ways of doing political polling after that to be better at straw polling. I mean, moving away from straw polling to random sampling, and they haven't missed elections since then. So that was the last one that was poorly called.
I had to go across this one.
Except for which one?
The Gore Bush, that's a good one. Gore Bush one. They predicted that Bush would win the popular vote, but Gore would win the electoral votes. I guess if you counted all the votes, maybe that would have been true. Maybe. Well, the Republican campaign slogan that Tom Dewey used in 128 was had enough, meaning had enough Democrats for, what, 20 years? Since 1932, almost? 18 years? 29 happened already. 129. Where do you say that? 130, we mentioned that, that Truman issued the executive order desegregating the U.S. military.
Which one is that?
Which is, yeah. And the way this is written with no number next to Jackie Robinson, I can imagine exactly what happened. After I made these sheets, I thought, wait a minute, I should have said this. It's a black thing, so I stuck it in there. Why was Jackie Robinson's recruitment by the Brooklyn Dodgers in 47 significant? Show the pictures.
What?
Show Jackie Robinson.
He was the first black person in
Major League Baseball.
Or not the... Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, any major league sport, okay. It was the first crossing over. Was football before that already?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Once I have to find it.
So with the.
But it wasn't major.
It's going to be around 1947-48.
Okay. Here's
good too.
In size.
A little bit.
Show that to our colleagues. We don't
pretty
want
sure
it on tape.
Pretty good for them to look past the old racism part of baseball. So were those made at the time or way afterwards?
This
you
book?
See this?
These front page.
I don't know how to do.
Like, oh.
That should be the textbook.
Where's the Bible?
It gets even wilder in the 50s. It's really good.
So
what do we have in common here with Truman's special session, with the Thurman candidacy, with the executive order, and the Brooklyn Dodgers?
We're becoming less racist.
Gradual, hard step-by-step efforts of civil rights. Yeah, very, very slow and gradual and measured steps towards trying to achieve civil rights, being blocked by those that are very much opposed to it. I mention this, that after the jobs in the defense plants opened up, and as more and more black migration moved to the north, as families gained more and more money, there was a demand to live in better housing. And there were a lot of those housing covenant codes set up to try to prevent anything but white purchased homes. And that became court order fights in each state.
Or now they're just set up to prevent people from putting up antennas.
Here's a movie that will really help illustrate exactly what I'm talking about. It's called Raisin in the Sun. I think it's a play originally by Lorraine Hansberry. Sidney Poitier plays in it, and it's about their family earns enough money to buy a home in a suburban middle white class neighborhood, and after they buy it and get ready to move in, they're approached by neighbors as well as legal people and to kind of threatened and pressured not to ever move in.
You see, this is totally off the subject, but Sidney Poitier named his daughter Sidney Poitier, and she was in that Grindhouse movie, and the opening credits had Sidney Poitier. And I didn't know that he had a daughter named Sidney Poitier.
So you thought he was in it?
So I thought Sidney Poitier was in the movie, but it was his daughter.
Flick.
But she does not have as cool a voice as Sidney.
He didn't name her that so she'd have a career in, did she? Try that. That fits exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, he was planning to.
You have to read the subcaption too on it.
Yep.
Can we read out loud?
You can't read out loud.
Oh my.
Can't read that part.
The Lagoon movie?
Oh, yeah.
The feature from The Lagoon there.
Such a good book.
Such a good book.
It's a book?
No, this book.
Oh.
Well, 131 we also did. I didn't talk about the second sentence, but remember I talked about how Loyalty oaths were established in the Attorney General's list during the Truman years in fighting communism. Here's one of the reasons why Truman was so adamant about being anti-Soviet. There was this belief that Democrats are softer on communists than Republicans are. The Republicans will really stand up for national security. The Democrats will roll over and let the commies take over. Now, why, after Democrats led the nation through World War I and II, does such an accusation have any bearing?
Last question.
How could...
Well,
they're acting like it. Some of them are acting like it. What would make the Democratic Party automatically accusable of being soft on communists?
Because they're liberal.
Because they're liberal. Because of the New Deal. Because they're left-leaning, quasi-socialist policies of the New Deal. So that's why in the Cold War period, you see Democrats trying to move away from that image, cutting back on social programs, trying to prove how much tougher they are than Republicans on communists. That's some of the reason for Truman's hawkish behavior, which Wallace found so wrong-headed.
What's the Attorney General's list?
Attorney General's list is the list of potential communists.
Which one are you talking about?
In number 131. HUAC was created during World War II, but it really gets its life during the Cold War period.
The list of communists?
Is that the Hollywood 10?
No, it's...
Oh, that's... We're going to come to that in a minute. Put a marker on that, because that's coming up here real soon.
We talk about the communist thing and then how they're making lists and not... But is that even... Right now, you can't...
We got a civil libertarian guy over here.
But...
Hate America guy
he
here.
He said that you can't be a member of Al-Qaeda and be in America.
That's not legally.
But I don't understand that. That's infringing on my constitutional rights.
But if you are the member of an organization whose sworn purpose is to overthrow the government, is that a legal organization?
What?
If you're a member of an organization who is actively and currently engaged in overthrowing our government, is our Constitution a suicide pact? Should we be allowed to let such memberships exist?
According to the Constitution, isn't that whole... as long as you're not the one...
I'm taking the opposition side. In spirit and theory, I'm with you. But it has been traditional for the courts to rule that when there is a serious, preeminent threat, clear and present danger, that such freedoms go on hold for national security.
What I'm afraid is that this is the list of Al-Qaeda people. They thought
like a 40-year Cold War?
And then 30 years from now, we'll be like, that's crazy.
We wouldn't do something like that. We didn't before.
Mr. John, at this point, are communists really trying to overthrow our government and create...
At this point in 2007?
No, in our history.
You know, that's a good comment.
Because were they really active?
Think about it. Let's not be so sarcastic and smarty pants here and actually think serious for a second. You know, the thing, in 1948, let's take it up a notch. 1950. By 1950, what's happened in Berlin?
We have to
airlift because the Russians tried to close off access. What happened in Greece and Turkey?
We
had to help against the communist uprising. What's happened? NATO has come into creation. Warsaw is on the way. The Russians proved they have now an atomic bomb. China turns communist in 1949. Korea, North, invades South. Is there a potential threat of communism in the world?
Yeah.
Now, I named overseas areas, but if the communists have agents working in our governments, working in our labor unions, teaching in our schools, being librarians, working to undermine the democratic values we have, there was a real climate for reasonable fear.
You could do a thing between, Salem Witch Trials and McCarthyism.
Called the play... What was the point?
Probably Crucible.
Crucible, yeah.
Yeah, just kidding.
That's what it was written for.
I don't know about that.
Wasn't Nixon on the QAC? Didn't he lead to
Nixon? Nixon's a story in and of himself. He's better than Strom. Nixon's coming up here. Okay, number 132.
Did you ever say what that QAC was?
Getting ready to now. The House Un-American Activities Committee.
Did you ever answer that question about that? So...
America was worrying about communists overthrowing the government of the United States, not just trying to reform it?
Yes.
They were worried that the entire...
There was the fear that, like fifth colonists in Spain, there were actually agents working to undermine and eventually destroy the defense capability of the country so the Russians could take over. And if the Marshall Plan is to persuade people not to be communists, isn't it reasonable to assume the communists are persuading our liberals to be communists?
But communists and Russians aren't synonymous. So are we fearing communism
or Russian? It was until 1949. Then it means Chinese and Russians. And after 49, then it means North Koreans, Chinese, and Russians, and eventually be Vietnamese.
So America could not become communist without becoming...
Good point. Could you be a communist member just by the rights of the First Amendment's free assembly spirit? Technically, yes, but case after case, depending on how vociferous you were as a communist or your behavior, got you in deep trouble with the potential of going beyond being in theory and being a true threat.
What I mean is, could the American government be changed to become communists, but not... I mean, you fear... They were fearing that America would become communist, but were they... To become communist doesn't mean you're being invaded by Russia.
So, maybe in current terms, could you become an extremist Islamist without necessarily being part of the jihad or the al-Qaeda?
Sure.
That's kind of the parallel. I think what you're saying, there are a lot of people who had the courage to speak up like you and protest the HUAC and protest the Hollywood 10 list. Lillian Hellman, the girlfriend of Dashiell Hammett, wrote about that and spoke about it. Some people, when called in front of HUAC, refused to testify, took jail terms for doing it because they said that our First Amendment rights are endangered by you more than the communists endanger our nation. But it was very unpopular to do that. If you were even brought before the HUAC committee and investigated or asked questions, you tended to lose job, lose friends, lose family. So just the possibility of being called a witch was enough to make you name names.
That unless you were Iron Man. We lost Charlie
Chaplin. I put it up there for you to check it out when you go.
Okay, I will. But that was part of the Nazi Party is pretty well discredited after
World War II. Like the Blues Brothers.
Well, okay, what you're talking about, there is a reemergence of Nazi Party members and Klan members with the civil rights issue of the 60s and 70s.
How can you be a member of the KKK in America but not a member of Al-Qaeda? How is that so?
Well, the KKK has not formally declared war on the United States.
Oh, yeah.
Al-Qaeda has. I know, in their behavior and attitudes and values.
What is a declaration of war? Like,
we want to
if the KKK made a video of lynching Americans, is that a declaration of war?
Yes, black Americans.
Whatever. Back to notes.
Of course, you know I'm sarcastically joking there. Because, you know, remember these go on the web and Bin Laden's listening to these.
And then... yourself.
In fact, they're saying, hey, there's one guy there that keeps wanting to help us recruit movies over there.
You're getting this thing in the mail.
My name is Andrew Austin.
Did you say your name was Barack Hussein Osama?
Okay.
But, you know, what you're asking is important because there were people who courageously asked those. ACLU fought constantly on those issues, and that's why the ACLU was so hated and distrusted, because why are they defending these you know, un-American people? But it's a great area of study. You can,
I think when you talk about the blacklist now, whenever you have a mass accusing thing, there's someone that's totally unrelated, you'll just throw them in the mix because you don't like them.
Mm-hmm.
If you're
curious to read about this, it's a book by Lillian Hellman called Scoundrel Days that deals with this abuse of the HUAC committee. Here's a really good movie that kind of captures the essence of it. I mean, it doesn't spend a lot of time on it, but it does an excellent job of capturing the mood. The only Jim Carrey film I like, The Majestic. Have you seen The Majestic? That's what he runs from in the beginning. He's going to be investigated by the HUAC committee, and he runs and then gets the amnesia at the end when he realizes he's not really the son of the movie owner. He has to go back and face those HUAC committee hearings. And the climate and the mood and everything is what you're talking about.
And he wasn't even a member. He was just trying to get laid.
Yeah. That's exactly why he was ahead of the association with the woman that was a communist. They never said whether he made it or not.
But he's
been
Who are we talking about? That's right.
The Majestic, the movie.
You can't read the Bible while listening to God.
Matthew's impressive, but I think he wouldn't be wanting to be saddled with that title.
We still have to get a picture. We still have to get a picture of that look and put it on the website.
But it is true that the HUAC went after the House Un-American Activities Committee in their efforts to draw people to Congress and ask you, have you ever been, or are you now a member of the Communist Party? Their real effort was to get people to say, I'm not, but I know who the real witches are, so they'd start naming names and turning people over.
When there weren't even any witches.
And they were in there, well, actually, remember Elia Kazan? You heard of him, I know you must. Elia Kazan, he was the film director of On the Waterfront. And
he got blacklisted.
And then he later said, I'll name names if you'll take me off the blacklist. And he got off the blacklist by naming names of people who were communists, which people at the time, A, praised because he was protecting their country from communists, B, said was a sellout. Name naming.
What was the deal with that movie? Like, what was in that movie that they...
The Majestic?
No.
I could have been a victim.
Instead of a bum, which is what I am now.
What are you talking about?
The line from On the Waterfront.
Was that the question? Yeah, what was in the movie that was...
Oh, in The Majestic, the one I was talking about?
No, they thought the director of that movie...
Gangs of New York!
Oh, okay.
I don't understand that view.
It's just a big argument.
No. No.
let's talk about Hollywood.
The Hollywood 10 was a list of Hollywood actors and directors who had some of which were accused and named, and others which volunteered to go to the HUAC committee and voluntarily testify. And in their testify, they wanted to defend people and attack the committee. And generally, whenever someone would try to attack the committee and defend someone's honor, they got shouted down by the committee and run off.
Is that what ended the golden age of Hollywood?
Is it over?
Yes.
I thought it was all that trashy F-word use in the 80s.
No, now they make all the movies in Canada.
No, I thought the... Never mind. I don't know. That's a real question.
Oh, okay. Well, there could be a link to the way movies... Well, speaking of that, if you notice in the early 50s, there are a lot of movies with John Wayne and others purposely go after the commies, smoking out commies. I Was a Communist for the FBI, Hidden Plant movie. There were actually quite a few films in that. Big Jim McLean, you ought to watch Big Jim McLean, where John Wayne finds all the Hawaiian communists and beats the shit out of them at the end of the movie, and everybody cheers because the communists were beaten up by John Wayne.
What's it called?
Big Jim McLean.
Never heard of that.
Yeah, you gotta see that one. There are some really very much orchestrated party line anti-Soviet movies made in the 50s. And that's why people who knew while the HUAC was going on, the more they put out an anti-Soviet movie, the more likely they are not to be called to the HUAC or lose their job.
You know, it shows something about modern America.
That we do the same now.
No.
We don't have to do that.
Conform or not.
Like, the movie Babel is about, and it even has some Middle Eastern segments about just miscommunication.
I think that's one of the things about the 60s that's worth praising. While the 60s was wild and misbehaving, it was a protest against restrictions and freedoms that have been turned back somewhat, but not completely.
But what I'm saying is that movie isn't about... because
selling the party line.
No, about beating. At the end of that movie, it's not killing a bunch of
Arabs.
Right. It's just how they're misunderstanding.
While we're wasting time, did you see The Siege with Denzel? Is it Denzel Washington?
In The Siege.
The Siege. Where he was a New York cop, and his assistant is the guy that plays Monk. In Arab Attendant.
Yeah.
And which this is pre 9/11.
That was yes.
But the hysteria leads to putting all the Arab people in New York City into detention centers and torturing them.
With Bruce Willis?
Yeah.
Playing...
That was a very, you know, precluding type film to the 9/11. Well, on with this. From 1947 to 1948, here is an incident that really gained a lot of attention. The arrest of Alger Hiss. Alger Hiss was a State Department official who had gone to Yalta with FDR. Hiss was accused in 1947 by Whitaker Chambers, so that comma shouldn't be there, by Whitaker Chambers as being a member of the American Communist Party all the way back to the 1930s. Whitaker Chambers himself had been a Communist Party member, admitted it, fessed up, quit the party, became a Time editor, Time News magazine editor, and was naming Hiss because he felt it was his duty to smoke out all the previous agents that he could name, said that Hiss used to send him State Department papers by way of hiding them in a pumpkin in a field, so-called famous pumpkin papers. Well, Hiss declared his innocence and was brought up before Congress. Nixon was a new politician from California, elected in 1946, a California congressman. His way of winning the election was to accuse, I think, Betty Voorhees of being a communist. Mm-hmm. Betty Voorhees, who was the sitting office holder when he ran against her, he named her, just accused her of being a communist, said he had evidence to prove it, and she lost re-election to him. There was no evidence to it. He was just a big lie. Just by calling communist in 1946, he could win election. And that's how Nixon got into public life. And then when he got on this committee investigating Alger Hiss, he was the one that became the special prosecutor, a prosecutor, who had Hiss tried not for espionage, because the statute of limitations had run on that, but on perjury, for denying that he was a spy. And in the trial that followed, a typewriter was brought forward that seemed to have, I think it was a Smith Corona style, that had a double type on some of the letters. And the pumpkin papers that were shown as evidence matched the typewriter that he owned. Now, it was a model that all those models did that. But he was the owner of one of those Smith Corona typewriters. And so on that basis and on Whitaker Chambers' testimony, Hiss was convicted of perjury. And it was Nixon that came out to be the big hero of it, because he was someone that was finding exactly what we were talking about. Are there real communists hiding in our government? To his dying days, Hiss continued to maintain his innocence and say that he had been framed and that all that was false. At the very end of his life, which I'm thinking was in about 91 or 92, there seemed to be some information coming out that might have illustrated that Hiss actually was guilty. And that's hard for we leftists who fought all those years for Hiss was a victim to admit to that. And that's kind of related to the West Wing episode, where the girl came to Sam, wanted her father's name cleared. She said he was innocent, but was accused of espionage. And he had already died, but she wanted the name rehabilitated. So he went to try to clear his name and discovered that he was guilty. Did you see that? It's kind of related to the Hiss thing.
But what did he do?
When he discovered that he really was guilty, he called her up and said, "I tried my best, but couldn't find any evidence to help you out." He didn't tell her the truth. Never told her that her father was really guilty. But this sure made Nixon a star. And so now Nixon was moving beyond just being a congressperson. He was the anti-Soviet Cold Warrior. And with the popularity that came with the conviction of Alger Hiss, he moved from Congress to Senate, elected to Senate in 1950. Then in 1952, what did he do?
Turn over the president?
Vice president. With Eisenhower and Nixon in 1952, and ran again in 1956. And the whole time, Nixon was embodying the harsh anti-Soviet attitude.
And then he sweated on TV.
You know what? He had slammed his like arm or something, leg in a car door.
Right before the...
So he was in excruciating pain during that debate, and that's why he looked like that.
I thought he had a cold.
No, he was in a lot of pain, and then Kennedy exploited it.
Which
is a good idea.
It is said that by watching on television, Kennedy looked relaxed and confident, Nixon looked worried and sick-like. But by listening to the debate on radio, they sounded equal. There was no difference in the voice on radio.
I remember this. We're talking about this.
I heard something about how...
This is the 1960 presidential debate.
Kennedy let him put makeup on.
Heard that too. And Nixon would not. And he had a 5 o'clock shadow from not shaving since the early morning. Yeah.
Did you know Nixon could play the piano?
Yeah.
Who was the president who could write in two different languages?
Garfield could write in Greek and Latin in one hand, and left hand was one language and right hand was the other.
Okay, that's just crazy.
Yeah, and it was decided that scholars like that are not needed, so he was shown up.
Yeah.
I meant to know. He was shocked, but that's not why. That's not why. Just want you scholars to feel appreciated out there.
Was that true? Can you really do that?
Yeah, you could.
Same time?
Your brain can do two different things.
You know, eventually you're like this.
Like two different things, or is it?
That's what was said.
Like he could write.
He pencil, got to write names.
But where I'm going with the Nixon story, I mean, there's so much more Nixon story to tell in regards to getting elected in 60. I mean, losing the election in 60 and then getting elected in 68 and the Watergate affair and all that. But the irony of this thing is that for making his whole career in the beginning and through much of his presidency being the hardliner against the Soviets, what's the irony at the end?
He backstabbed his own country.
Well, that, and he gets out of Vietnam.
By going to China. I'm not agreeing with your statement. I think he backstabbed. When he and others saw that there was a rift growing between the Soviets and the Chinese.
And he abandons King Chiang-Chek in Taiwan.
So rather, we didn't reckon, let me do a quick little China story here. The communists took over China in 1949, shoved Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists over to the island of Taiwan. So from 1949 on, China has been communist. And from 49 till 79, for 30 years, we refused to just like we didn't recognize the Soviets until 1930, we didn't recognize China's real government for 30 years. The UN took them into its body in 1971, but we still, as late as 79, had not recognized China. Yet, as early as 72, Nixon saw that there was trouble brewing between China and Russia. And if you could divide these two communist nations, that would really make it better for us in the West. So without even formal diplomatic relations with China, Nixon made a trip to China and met all their leaders and buddied up. And it is said that went a long way towards unfreezing relations and worsening Chinese-Russian relations. So isn't it odd that the biggest cold warrior was the one who went to China and undid the freeze? You all must be Star Trek fans, right? And you've all seen the one where they tried to stop the bad relations with the Klingons? And Kirk. So you'll appreciate this thing. Kirk hates Klingons because they killed his son. I mean, obviously, in the movie, the Klingons are the Soviets, and Spock says to Kirk, only Nixon could go to China. And now you get the meeting of it.
Did he really say that?
In the movie, yeah.
He said only Nixon could go.
To imply that only somebody who was a Cold Warrior like Shatner could be the one who could renegotiate with Klingons. Anybody else wouldn't be trusted.
Okay, was this one of the movies or one of the episodes?
Undiscovered Country.
A movie?
Part 6.
Is that a movie or
one? Yeah, it's a movie. Okay. This one is the lousier one, so that's a good thing.
A couple items from now.
The giant poster?
Yeah.
That's what we just did.
Oh, that's number 136.
Well, I jumped ahead out of order, but I remember I talked about the communists in 49 took over China.
The giant poster of Mao seizes power in China.
I don't think that. Well, it's because the Chinese used to do a lot of big poster parades.
And then they took the Dalai Lama.
We have to watch the last Super Bowl right now. There's nothing to do with that.
You said the last Samurai. Is that what you
said? Last Emperor.
Never mind.
Have you ever heard of the Burma Shave signs?
No.
They used to have a thing on the highway before the interstates, on those boring state highways where they would put commercial signs up one after another. And there was a commercial routine set up by Burma Shave, a type of shaving cream, in which it would say part of a sentence, and they'd finish the sentence and part of the next sentence, and you'd be watching every so many mile markers for the next sign, and finally, after all the cute little slogan went by, it'd be, "Buy Burma Shave." That's the way it was set up. Well, look at this here. The Burma Shave copywriter wins Pulitzer. Claus Fuchs. We've got to talk about Claus Fuchs.
Fuchs. Pronounce it normally.
Well, as I said before, in 1949, the Soviets tested off an atomic bomb. So from 45 to 49, only we had it, not them. But then things were equalized and very much more, we became frightened by the successful testing of the bomb. How did they get the technology? Well, here's how, yeah. Claus Fuchs was a German-born British scientist who worked on the Manhattan Project, which I didn't say a word about during the World War II studies. Shut up.
Oh.
What was the Manhattan Project?
The building of the bomb.
Yes.
Communities.
Yes.
Have you ever seen that letter from Albert Einstein to Truman?
Mm-hmm.
I've heard of it, but I haven't
the
seen
one
it.
That they wrote and then had it.
Like the one where he advocates. I've seen the one to FDR, though.
Oh, I'm not with FDR. I might be wrong.
Yeah, yeah, where he suggested that a bomb could be built. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah, Truman didn't show up until the bomb was pretty much done.
That's true. It was probably FDR.
So, Claus.
Claus Fuchs was a British scientist who was working on the Manhattan Project with American scientists to build the atomic bomb. What people did not realize was that at the same time he was helping develop the bomb, he was keeping his own separate copy of all the research and all the knowledge. And later, after World War II, passed it through the Rosenbergs to the Russians. Julius and Ethel Rosenbergs were American communists.
The Jello Box people.
American Communist Party members who were put on trial and convicted for espionage and were, if I'm correct, the only people to be executed for espionage in peacetime.
Okay, they're Americans.
They're American, Jewish Americans.
They
Fuchs gave them the knowledge and through their Communist Party connections, they pass it on to the Russians, and that's how the bomb was discovered.
They are the Jello Box people, aren't they?
J. Edgar, I don't know what that is. But J. Edgar Hoover.
It's like they put their information on the lips of
pushed hard for both of them to be executed, although, as we look back at it now, the evidence only proves Julius is doing it, and Ethel just was in the family, but she was executed anyway at the time. And when it was Hoover was asked whether or not there was some injustice in her execution, his answer was somewhat to the effect of, like, well, that'll scare other spies from.
Who said this?
J. Edgar Hoover.
Oh,
he's crazy.
Right. Yeah.
Protecting America from communists.
Yeah. In a heartless bastard kind of way, he would give that for the
culture. We used to have in our library, we might still, like, that 7 copies, paperback edition of How to Detect Communism in Your Society by J. Edgar Hoover.
I have that book.
You have it, I think of the title, but it's something
else. Yeah, it has a picture of him on it. Yeah. I wanted it because it's crazy.
Yes.
It was at the library bookstore. It was like a quarter.
Is it funny?
I haven't read it. That guy's crazy. It'll mess with my mind. I'm too impressionable.
I want to waste everybody, especially those people online, time by telling us a quiz bowl story.
About Claus Fuchs. Pronunciation of Fuchs.
Yeah. I won't say who, but a former Northside player that helped us win first place in 2001. Captain.
I think the trophy that was there.
Always kept wanting to say he couldn't wait till someday that Alexander Dumas, the French writer, came up as an answer because he was gonna answer dumbass.
He said it was Dumas.
That's what really happened. He said he was going to do that if Dumas came up. And then I said, please don't do that. Please. Especially for on television, don't do that. Well, at one of the games right before television, the Sorcerer's Apprentice composer, Dukas, what's his first name? Paul? Paul Dukas, I think. Yeah, his name came up, so he answered duck ass. Just straight face, didn't smile. The judge looked at him with a funny light and he repeated it. And he looked so innocent they gave him credit. Because it is spelled Dukas, you know, it is spelled that way, silent S on the end. And we went to the television and we were watching the early games and one of the answers came up was Alexander Dumas. So I looked at the captain said, well, that's the end of that. Dumas done and passed. You can't do it now. He goes, Claus Fuchs hasn't come yet. Unfortunately, it didn't. 135.
Like, you have to open the whole can of worms.
They don't normally have to.
Sorry, Ben Laden, if that bothers you. That.
I was saying the state finals are fine.
They are tonight, 6 p.m., aren't they?
In 5 minutes.
In 5 minutes, the final.
Southside will reverse Cabot in the state finals in 5 minutes.
Cabot will seriously murder them.
Make much of them there.
We could. Yeah. Well, let's just do this here. All we've talked about so far has been the 40s. We've just barely crossed into 1950, and the fact we mentioned the Korean War starts in 50, and Julius and Ethel Rosenberg situations in the 50-53. So most of the Cold War we've talked about so far has been during the Truman administration and has been in the 1940s. Yet you tend to think of Joseph McCarthy as being the big high point of the Cold War, the Red Scare. And it's mistaken, a lot of people will falsely assume that McCarthy started the Red Scare. not the case at all. He moved into an atmosphere that was well in place and took advantage of it. McCarthy was a Wisconsin. You need the sheet?
Looking for what paper I was taking notes on.
McCarthy was a Wisconsin senator who in 1946 ran for office claiming that he had been a tail gunner on an airplane and had a leg injury in World War II. After getting elected, it was discovered that he spent his whole World War II career flying a desk, I think in Wisconsin. And that during the campaign, it was discovered that he had limped on both left and right legs, taking different turns to suggest his injury.
Who?
Joseph McCarthy.
Oh, wait a
second. So
he was also a drunk.
He's coming up. Hold on to that thing. That's fine.
Still sitting here holding on.
So McCarthy, as a senator, didn't do well. And in fact, one of the things he did that got him some ill repute was he was hired by the German government to defend German prison camp guards who had mistreated American soldiers during World War II. And that the reason he took it was because there's so many German-American voters in Wisconsin that were upset with the accusation of cruelty by the German guards. But nationally, he wasn't all very popular for doing that. And in 1950, as he looked upon how well his prospects for re-election came, it looked like he wasn't going to get it because the Senate always takes a vote of its own members. Who's the best? Who's the worst? He scored worst. Worst member of the Senate by their own fellow vote in 1950.
They do that every year?
They used to. I don't know if they do anymore. And
no, so that would be too political now.
So anyway, he called some friends together for small dinner and drinks and to talk about what's he going to do with his career. I think there was a priest there and a couple of businessmen. Said, I need an issue badly. I need an issue that I can run for re-election on, something that'll clean up my past. And the businessman said, what you ought to propose is a complete redredging and rebuilding of the St. Lawrence River into someday a St. Lawrence Seaway, which was done later anyway. That'll bring a lot of commerce to the Great Lakes, especially Wisconsin. He said, well, that's just not the mood of the country. I need something that's national mood. And the priest said, why don't you go after something that is a real serious threat? And that is, how many communists are hiding in the U.S. government? He said, well, I don't know of that many. He goes, well, you'll have to find them. And so McCarthy, for the sake of re-election, went around claiming he knew of names of people that were communists. In fact, his first speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, was, I have a list in my hand of 205 card-carrying communists. The next day he moved to Salt Lake City and said he had like 57 card-carrying communists in a list.
Oh, and there's another one that says 205 card-carrying book readers at libraries.
That's where that...
But that one.
And this one, it shows him, like, this is the actual photo of him speaking in Wheeling, West Virginia, saying, I have a hold in my hand a list of 205 liquor stores. That's because he was an alcoholic himself. In the final days of his life, he drank a fifth of bourbon a day and died of hepatitis.
A fifth of bourbon? Like a whole bottle?
Mm-hmm.
It says in there that the senator warns the liquor stores to have plenty of Mr. Boston rum on hand because that is the brand he suspects most.
Clues to rooting out Red conspiracy may lie at the bottom of bottles. Crusading lawmaker vows to drain every last drop of commie beverages.
And he does.
These writers are so skillful.
What's this finally saying?
They're going to say, gee, what is this textbook that everybody's talking about?
What is this finally saying?
Something about the book.
Century, what is that?
Well, as this, here's what unfolds here. McCarthy gets on this kick of naming names, or not actually naming numbers, and people start demanding names. So finally, after he's pushed, he starts picking on newspaper reporters. Who else did he pick on? There was some directors in Hollywood.
You brought in a few secretaries.
Owen Lattimore, who was a member of the State Department, he accused of being the highest-ranking State Department communist that had undermined our policies towards China and Korea.
Yeah, that was bad.
So, I mean, he's making strong accusations without proof to it, but it was one of those things where, rather than people fighting back, it was just, we don't want to get named, so don't say anything or you'll be next on his list and named. And that included even President Eisenhower refused to discipline him. And people ask Eisenhower in private, what do you think about McCarthy? And he says, well, this is not good for our nation, but it's not politically wise for me to speak at this time. So that's how much...
Edgar R. Murrow went after him.
Did the movie, what is it? That's about, exactly. If you watch that movie, you see what this is about in here. Very good film. He was given an overseas job, or not, he was given a job in the Senate to investigate the libraries in our overseas embassies.
Which is the southern one.
And he just, in his opinion, he started weeding out all the books that he thought were too liberal and too leftist and had them destroyed. Book burning.
Which is right here.
Overseas embassy libraries.
What was his job?
To root out which particular books were too liberal or too dangerous and be removed from the shelves and destroyed.
Okay, what books were left?
But doesn't book burning, is that what this is?
You have to actually read the text.
MacArthur shifts focus and will now fight book reading menace.
But you have to read the text on that one. The text is awesome. There's a list of MacArthur's suggestions. The last one is don't think.
Why would somebody like this be able to be not only able to get away with it, but be so powerful and no one would cross him? And in many ways, the press hung on every word.
Because that's what America wanted to read about and no one wanted to disagree.
Yeah. So if someone today said they had a list of Al-Qaeda members that are working for our government or working in Hollyweird, the Sean Hannity, we call it.
Hollywood?
Sean Hannity calls Hollywood Hollyweird because of all the leftists. If somebody came forward and said they had a list of known Al-Qaeda agents working in Hollywood or working for the U.S. government, would they be laughed at, or would they be front page news?
Laughed at. Well, I should be front page news, and then everyone would laugh at it.
Everybody would laugh.
After McCarthy, it'd be harder to pull it off, but he was the first to do it. That's why it worked.
Now you can get away with it with terrorists.
As more and more names came forward, he became more popular and more influential, and was reelected. But then he went too far and named members of the army, and that's what this is about. When he started naming George Marshall and other top-ranking army officials as being having been communists since way back, the army fought back and said, we want to appear before the Senate and you show proof or otherwise you have to recant what you said. And so he hired people to take photographs of Russian agents and splice it to look like they were shaking hands with these Americans of the army that were accused. And they were poorly done. It was like the lighting was different on both sides. The hands were bigger where they're at. It looked pretty crappy.
Why would you pick someone so hard to do?
But apparently they were televised, one of the earliest televised hearings, and on television people finally got to see courageous senators standing up to McCarthy, and as he couldn't come back to protect his lies quick enough, he stumbled and stuttered, and within a few days times had been completely shamed, and the threat of McCarthy at that point shrank. And that's when his drinking problems got worse, and he went into a sanitarium and eventually died in 56 or 57.
And that's what the censure means?
Yeah, when a censure is when you've been formally scolded or reprimanded by the Senate. Like, Clinton almost got censured. Joe Lieberman said, let's have a censure, we don't need a impeachment. But they went for impeachment.
What happened to McCarthy?
Again, his star sunk quickly and he disappeared from the scene from illness. Yeah. But McCarthyism became...
How long did he last?
Something about 50 to 54.
Now he broke a law, though. He intentionally hurt someone's name.
The defamation?
Yeah, defamation.
That's a civil tort.
Slander or libel? I mean, he had a lot of people.
I mean, you can be sued civilly, but that's not a criminal offense.
But what's the lesson of McCarthy? That's the point we need to get at.
Watch out for the demagogues.
That's it. That's a good point. That is how easy it is when the climate of a nation is in a certain direction to demagogue an issue and get away with it and stir up more fear. And again, I say this with, think about what had been going worldwide in terms of Berlin and North Korea and China. And the atmosphere was very fearful of real communist threats worldwide. It's not out of bounds to believe they are working after Alger Hiss. How many more Alger Hisses were actually working behind the scenes?
I don't understand. McCarthy... If a newspaper or something had done that, they would have been shut down and they would be punished if they libeled some or deflamed someone's name falsely. But there's no punishment for McCarthy doing that?
That's slander.
Why did no one say, can you prove it?
Well, they finally did. The army did force him to come forward.
Is it making false?
I think it's a case of when you are speaking for the majority of prejudice, nobody wants to challenge it. Sure, it was a law, but if you went against McCarthy, you must be a communist.
Okay, but then afterwards, when he got...
Afterwards, he shrank so quickly, and was put into the sanitarium, it was kind of like everybody knew that there was no longer need to go after him. He was no longer a threat.
Maybe if they had made a formal reprimand or something,
so you're saying
that wouldn't happen again.
Even after Bush has lost midterm elections, there should be an impeachment? Just to make it clear that you can't get away with those kind of wars?
Yeah.
Kick a dog while he's down there?
Okay. Ida's listening right now.
Yeah, that was for Osama there.
George Bush is listening to me.
That's the look.
Should that be the look on the website?
Fox News.
We just...
Well, 136 is true. We already said this. But it's important for 137 because we remember North and South Korea was set up in the two halves, Russian and American, in 48. But with China turning communist in 49, now Russians and Chinese are communists. Think about how, here's our world here. If trees and rocks vote, look how many communists there are. And in China, there's a lot of real ones. I think this morning that 20% of the world is Chinese.
40%?
20%. 40? So think, all of this, the Soviet Union is communist, Eastern Europe's communist, North Korea was communist, now all of China is communist.
Australia and India, too.
You can well imagine why McCarthy in 1951 would be listened to because of what's going on worldwide.
Mao,
something like that happened nowadays.
Mao Zedong led the Communist Party to overcome China and set up the People's Republic of China, shoving the nationalist leader of China prior to this, Chiang Kai-shek, off to the island of Taiwan, which would call itself the Republic of China.
And it's now officially recognized by the U.S.
We recognized Taiwan only from 49 until 79.
And then we.
Then in 79, we dropped recognition of Taiwan as anything other than just Taiwan. They're not the Republic of China anymore, and we recognized and said the people.
But we recognized them as Taiwan then?
I thought we were recognizing them as a rebellious province of the People's Republic of China.
They're not China. That's the one that we don't recognize.
Because we defend them, we tell China not to attack.
Yeah, but I don't think we actually recognize them.
And in the 50s, during the Eisenhower years, there was lots of threats about what if the Communist Chinese say they will take Taiwan, will we defend them? And our official position was yes. And that was made even more aggravated by the Korean War breaking out right in the same locale. June of 1950, North Koreans invade South Korea across the 38th parallel. What's our response?
We defend South Korea.
Immediately, MacArthur leaves Japan and brings U.S. troops over to South Korea to come to the defense. A special session of the U.N. Security Council meets and votes to come to South Korea's aid.
The U.N. works.
Well, think for a second why it worked, though, because wasn't it supposed to be set up with one veto could stop action?
It didn't work because China and Russia wouldn't veto it.
Why didn't the Russians veto it?
Because if they veto it, then they look like the imperialist aggressors.
Here's why. Because the China sitting on the Security Council was still Taiwan, not communist China.
What about Russia?
And because of that, Russia was pissed off and boycotting and refusing to go to UN meetings. So when the Security Council meeting came, they weren't there to vote against it. They moved real quick and authorized UN forces. The Russians have not skipped a Security Council meeting since. That is how forces got in. And as this map shows, the communist advance was so decisive that they shoved UN forces and American forces all the way down to this little corner of the tip of the peninsula called Pusan, P-U-S-A-N. In 1951, MacArthur takes a very daring move by attacking at what's called Incheon. And the reason that's daring is because, like, the way the seas and the tides and the cliffs are, you can only make a successful landing about once a month. And he chose that. Nobody thought he could pull it off, and he did, and he landed, and as a result, routed North Koreans and shoving them northward and capturing a number of them south of that area.
Oh, here's the article for that.
For Korea?
Well, for the dismissal of MacArthur.
Okay, you're...
Stan Levon says MacArthur vows to liberate North Pole.
Yeah, you're ahead of me on that. That'll make sense here in a minute. Come on up. As MacArthur shoves forces northward all the way up to the border of the Yalu River, which is the border of North Korea and China, Truman becomes deeply concerned and worried about how far is he going to take this war. Plus, MacArthur has made comments that he plans to not only liberate all of Korea, put that under non-communist control, but why not move into China and restore Chiang Kai-shek and Peking?
Maybe because
it's, China. By 1950, there are Russian A-bombs.
Let's not do that.
And
does MacArthur know that?
Yeah.
That's what Truman's wondering. So Truman flies to Korea and they have a conversation, and two things are asked, you know, are you willing to follow my commands and orders about I set the policy, not you? And he goes, yes, I am, because you're the president and commander in chief. Second, what's your opinion on the involvement of Chinese communists? Are they likely to enter this war? And he said he thinks it's very unlikely because they'd suffer huge losses and they're still suffering from just winning their own revolution. But to the surprise of many, around Thanksgiving of 1950, Chinese volunteers, some 600,000, cross the Yalu and route the South Korean UN forces all the way back to the 38th parallel, where the war stagnated until 1953.
Although they supposedly lost like 1 million people in doing that.
Mm-hmm. If you watch MASH regularly, that is primarily, most of MASH is after they've been pushed back to the parallel, waiting for the treaty to happen.
Oh, there's that one episode where they go into China.
They themselves?
Rainbow Bridge.
Rainbow Bridge is one of the ones that...
That's one of my favorite episodes ever.
The real Rainbow Bridge is one that MacArthur got so furious about because he was given orders he could bomb the southern half of the bridge, not the northern half of the bridge, for fear that he'd start the war with Soviets. Well, MacArthur did not keep his mouth shut.
Huh? Rainbow Bridge is like, it's the prisoner exchange one where they meet the guy that graduated with Henry. Mm-hmm. From
what is Rainbow Bridge?
It's the bridge across the Yellow River.
Oh. From the University of Illinois.
There are a lot of names on this
one.
Tusan's is that region that they controlled early. Incheon is the area where they invaded. MacArthur is the dude that did the invading. 38th parallel is the original border. Yellow River is the river that borders North Korea and China. And the Chinese are the people that brought troops down.
That's true.
Cool. Wish I could lecture like that.
Well, you did all the.
What you do, you just tell the story, make it so much more entertaining.
That's like PowerPoint here.
That was just a list of facts.
Well, MacArthur continued to make very belligerent policy statements about wanting to use atomic bombs and wanting to restore Chiang Kai-shek. And after being told time and time again to shut up, MacArthur sent a letter to Republicans in the Senate advocating what policy he thought they should tell the president that should be administered. And when that letter was read in the Senate floor, Truman was infuriated and said, that's it, we're firing MacArthur, because this guy doesn't understand. Omar Bradley, one of the World War II soldiers called the Citizens General, had already called Korea the wrong war at the wrong place at the wrong time. And what the fear was is that MacArthur is going to turn the Korean situation into World War III if he doesn't shut up and stop all the heaviness. Their thinking was the real hot spot to worry about is still Berlin and still Germany, rather than this area.
So he wrote to the Senate?
The Republican opposition in the Senate wrote a letter complaining about Truman's policies. Which in the military, you're not supposed to just do that to your commander-in-chief. So that's why Truman on April 11th, 1951 surprises many by formally firing MacArthur.
Well, at the end of that...
And MacArthur came back... Maybe I need to tell this. MacArthur, when he returned, after being dismissed, was welcomed to a number of cities with ticker tape parades, and then he was given a chance to speak in front of joint houses of Congress and all of this. He became the big hero, and at first Truman looked like, how dare Truman fire the man with the military experience, but in time the exotic ideas of MacArthur became obvious in his speeches and people came to realize that Truman had made the right decision. A famous quote by MacArthur was at the end of his joint houses of Congress speech. As I end my military career, I'm reminded of the old refrain, old soldiers never die, they just fade away. That's MacArthur's final words.
Wow. Who was he replaced with?
Matthew Ridgway.
Ridgway, that's
I haven't thought of that fact in years.
The end of that one says, Truman's still looking for a diplomatic way to fire MacArthur, afraid he'll shift east and invade U.S.
That's the first Matthew in all of American history that's in
Harry Perry.
William Jennings Bryan is Matthew Harrison Brady in the movie.
Find me one Kenneth in American history. Do it now.
I did say Jeremy. They're all Johns.
Morty Crocker and Betty Crocker executed for selling top secret cake recipes to the Reds. To the Reds.
People are going to get those jokes mixed up with the lecture.
MacArthur advances to Arctic Circle, plans to liberate polar region. Unstoppable General defies Truman's orders, continues to advance north. The North Pole shall be free of communists by 1952, MacArthur pledges.
Yep. First you go through it, it also says he dropped roots on China and all that stuff.
That's not real. That's
they're
going to
put on their SAA and made the North Pole.
They said Truman afraid he'll shift east and invade the U.S. to be ours.
Residents of New Mexico given cardboard 3D glasses for protection against atomic radiation.
That's how John Wayne died.
Anyway.
Well, it was probably Will's lung cancer.
From when he made the movie The Barbarian.
Yeah.
And they did it out in the sands of Nevada. Yeah. And they were testing nearby and all those people died.
He also smoked quite a lot of cigarettes.
He'd be 100 years old today, or this year.
Really? Mm-hmm.
You're going to be 17 years old tomorrow.
How old is this?
Well, after... Why did somebody ask who replaced MacArthur?
I was wondering...
Because
know,
I asked it, because I know from MASH.
Go on the
I just know who it was. Oh. Yes, I did. And then you picked it up and said it louder. Did you not
you have to read the list.
Atomic explosions today list. Tourists, contact your local Atomic Energy Commission office for maximum visibility areas. Bikini Atoll, Kwajalein Atoll, Inuwik Atoll. These are real ones.
Yeah. No, keep reading through it.
You think my
day
is so horrible?
It's kind of dirty.
It says Cook Islands, Nameless Island, 184 miles off the coast of San Diego. Omaha, Nebraska, Varro.
All right, that's all. Focus back.
We're never doing that.
In 1953, after long, arduous negotiations, a treaty was concluded at Pan Mun Jom, and that's the name of the treaty. And the influences of what kind of brought that treaty around was the election of 1952. Eisenhower, the Republican candidate, after getting elected, and thus was president-elect from 52 into 53, sent a message to the Indian ambassador, because we didn't have formal relations with China, who spoke to the Chinese ambassador to tell China that once Eisenhower becomes president, if there's not a treaty concluding the war, they might or have to worry about him using atomic bombs.
Did China not have
them? No, China didn't have them. Russians did.
And the Russians could give it to China.
They could have. So that's but there's a factor that figures into this now. So first of all, Eisenhower gives this threat that after he's president, he may use the atomic bomb. Second, there was a big argument and debate about North Korean soldiers that had been captured in the routing. They didn't want to go home. They wanted to stay in South Korea. And the North demanded that those soldiers be repatriated, even if they don't want to be. And then a third incident was the death of Stalin. Stalin dies in 1953. So when they're not clear what the Russians will do without Stalin, the Chinese and the North Koreans figure this is a time with the Eisenhower threats, we better negotiate. So they agreed to the Pan Mun Jom Treaty, which left the border between the two nations there with forces on either side, as it has been since 1953, up to this point now.
And Stalin had died?
The death of Stalin made the Chinese and North Koreans unsure of how far will they be backed by Russia.
Why is it that so many American wars go back to the status quo?
Because we don't imperialize, we just kill people and leave.
Because you have to keep fighting if you want to win something. That's how you can get to peace.
Yeah, Spanish-American War, we took over Cuba.
You know, Stalin presided over probably the killing as many of his own people as World War II did, some 20 million. Mm-hmm. And it says, in persecutions and purges, etc. And here's Stalin's picture, and it says, Soviets mourn loss of Stalin, 1953. Who will crush our spirits and destroy our will to live now, asks a distraught citizen. New medical report. Here's this guy and girl kissing, and she's in a tight sweater. And it says, new medical report finds heavy petting linked to communism. Touching cells others in pure manner exposes as Bolshevik plot.
Hey, can I see that, Mr. Jones? I think I need to hold on to that.
The lecture.
Whoa! You guys have to focus.
Are you guys going to want this book when we're done?
Calm down, everyone.
Well, actually, I'm going to need to leave.
Okay, I better hurry then. 52 election, I already alluded to this. 52, Eisenhower and Nixon ran against the same candidate for the Democrats twice in a row. Adlai Stevenson, the governor of Illinois, ran in 52 and ran in 56. The significant things about the 52 and 56 elections is in both cases there was an effort moved to dump Nixon from the ticket. The Republicans thought Nixon was too mean-spirited to win votes. And in the first election, he was accused of receiving payoff bribes in the form of investment bonds. And so the move was made to get the party to dump him, and he made the comment that before you kick me out, let me make a television appearance, and I'll defend myself, and then we'll let public opinion ride in after that, and if they want me off, I'll quit. And so he gets up and gives his television speech in which he says that he and his family had been accused of receiving illicit gifts. And he said, well, we have received something in the mail, and we're not going to give it back. And he says, it's this little puppy dog, Checkers, for my daughter. My daughter just loves Checkers, and no matter what they say, we're keeping it. And by the way, my wife doesn't wear a mink coat like some candidates, alluding to Adlai Stevenson's wife. He says, we just wear a simple Republican cloth coat because that's all we can afford. The famed Checker speech of Nixon, and it worked wonders. And they all wrote in and said, keep him on the ticket.
Anybody will fall for a puppy.
So the interesting thing here is that Nixon always complained that the press did him unfair, that the TV debate in 60, the press did him wrong and cost him the election. But he'd saved his career in 52 with the Checker speech by the press. He then blames the 61. And then in 62, when he runs for the governorship of California and loses that too, he decides he's quitting politics. He calls a special press conference and says, I just want to announce to the world that I'm leaving, that you've had your fun with me, that you'll no longer have Dick Nixon to kick around. Disappears until 1968, comes back and runs as president.
Oh, he's back.
Such a character. Look at 142. Bleeping ball scares America. But you've got the book, so we can't show it. 3-foot bleeping ball scares America. 142. Is it working?
Yep. I believe the actual headline is 3-foot bleeping 10 ball threatens free world.
Let's explain what that means in 142.
Spending one.
People were shocked to learn,
what's
I believe.
What's that Sparkman?
Oh, okay. I don't think that's going to be on the AP test.
Okay.
The Democrats. Here's a little quick piece of interest here. John Sparkman of Alabama was the running mate of Adlai Stevenson in 52. Of course, they lost. And Estes Kefauver of Tennessee was the running mate of Adlai Stevenson in 56. The way Kefauver was chosen was not by just the way top candidate makes a selection and goes with that. Stevenson said, I have no special person chosen for the running mate, so I'll leave it to the convention and you can elect them. So one of the rare times that I know of ever happening, the Democratic Convention of 1956 held an election to choose the running mate. And the person who came in third place was Al Gore Sr., Al Gore's father, former senator of Tennessee. And the person who came in second place was JFK, which helps explain why 4 years later he's a candidate for the party in 60. Have you seen in Back to the Future? When Marty says he lives over on JFK Boulevard, and the father says, who the hell's that? This is 1955. Well, this is a senator of 3 years already from Massachusetts, but nobody knew him then. He gets known in this election that he came in second, and then he gets to be candidate in 60.
Then the actor.
Oh, yeah. Well, who did win was Kefauver. Estes Kefauver became the vice presidential running mate. And Kefauver was famous as being the lead of the Senate investigating committees on mafia hearings. So if you see Godfather Part II, when they're asking questions of Michael Corleone and the brother from the Italy is brought in and all that, that's Kefauver running all those committees.
Really?
Yeah. 3-foot bleeping ball time.
10 ball.
Okay. 1957, America is shocked to learn that the Russians have placed a satellite in orbit around the Earth.
That all it does is transmit a Morse code identifier and some telemetry.
But if they can put something into orbit and we can't, what does that mean?
Falling behind.
That we're behind.
Stuff up from space.
That's
like
right. That eventually they can put things. That's exactly the fear. Is that they can put things into space that will drop bombs on us and we can do nothing about it because we're so far behind in the space race.
You know, what if they hadn't
Find a dog one. Get the book back from me.
What if they hadn't made it known, though, and then America wouldn't have had that boost?
Well, that's true. That's true. I mean, they were proud to take because they wanted America to feel. In fact, the argument was, how could a group of back...
Which one do you want?
Have you ever seen October Sky?
Slavs come up with the technology.
Do you want leaping 2 foot Tim Ball?
Head of dog killing contest.
Okay, dog killing contest, because there's also outer space balls to come.
We were trying also to get things into space, but most of our attempts in 56, 57, 58 had blown up on the launch pads or fallen over. And
what
so
about space for a while?
Please. Okay.
Have you ever seen October Sky?
Yes.
I have.
You know when they walk out and they're looking at the sun and they make...
Yeah, it's a good film.
Racial remarks to the Russians.
In addition to getting the first satellite up, the Russians were the first to get an animal into space. They sent dogs into space. The first dog was named Laika, L-A-I-K-A, and our first animals were monkeys. The difference was this.
Well, no, I think they reintroduced.
They let their dogs die in space and didn't bring them back. Our monkeys came back alive. So that's why this article shows Laika here with the oxygen mask on, and Laika is a Soviet space program, a hidden dog killing race.
Was Yuri the first person, the first thing to go to space for Russia that didn't die?
Yuri Gagarin?
Yeah.
It takes Sputnik eventually does.
But let's look at the ramifications of what's, while our people walk
which
off, would be, you know, outer space falls to communists.
Yeah. So did Russia know that we were having all these failed attempts,
mm-hmm,
and they were like kind of teasing and taunting us?
Funny you mention that, because most of our tests in Florida were visibly covered by covered by news media.
Like every time we would try to test.
Yes, yeah. And theirs were hidden in Siberia and other places. They never would reveal where the things were going on because they knew that a lot of they had a lot of failures and deaths that occurred. Yeah, and we were an open democracy. But the impact here is that Americans say, if we are that far behind in science and space technology, and we're supposed to be the leader of the free world, the problems are our education system. And so in response to Sputnik, we have the first Federal Education Act passed, in which federal monies are given to schools. Until Sputnik, there was no federal money ever given to public schools. It was all local funding. And started in science and math, but eventually went in all realms. So you could say Sputnik helped finally get education federally funded. But it also adds to the fear of the Cold War, and it's not surprising now why what was one of the early pledges of Kennedy after being elected president?
Man walk on the moon.
Yeah, we'll have a man walk on the moon within a decade's time, because he wanted to make sure that Americans didn't fear we'd fall behind the space race with the Russians.
You know what? That's kind of like the space race.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a college's football team.
In that?
Because, like, college's football teams kind of reflect their caliber of education, or their sports teams, because it shows funding and everything like that. And how's our space program?
But you know what the argument is that... that there's more immediate social needs for our money than space can offer. I mean, spending on space is a luxury rather than a necessity.
If you think about year that this happened.
It results in a lot of...
It does. Tang. Teflon.
No,
Tang is the greatest thing in the whole world.
I love that stuff.
Plus a country reaching goals.
I
agree. I'm pro space race.
And live. For 2 years.
But I do see the argument also about...
Well, I don't know where this money is going anyway. I don't know where all these social reforms that the space race money's...
Well, if we're going to take anywhere, how about Iraq rather than...
Okay.
Mr. Jones?
Yes.
Have you ever noticed that the progression of the space race is really kind of like a byproduct of them trying to build ICBMs?
That's true. It was defense-oriented in the beginning, and it always has been tied
in.
And probably
the reason the U.S. was so far behind is because we had bombers and set missiles.
Yeah, that's true. And good point also to be made this, that the space race loses support everywhere when the Cold War starts to wind down because there isn't as much fear and danger. In fact, what we do find is by the late 70s, I think it is, the Soviet... Soyuz, American joint programs together. We start working with the Russians, docking things in space and man-walking together. That really illustrates, well before the Cold War is over, the thawing of the Cold War. Here's what we need to look at. We've changed now 143 through 146 as they look at social culture of the 50s.
Which was one of those questions,
I don't have
146.
It sure was, and it has been a question twice in the last decade.
I don't have a 146.
I don't
either. Yeah. Our topic 145, 144 going to the 1960s.
Was that not one of the ones that...
I don't have any.
So that one, the machine never did copy at all, and we have no extras in it. Well, have we reached a pause point then?
I was about to say that.
Would you do this? Would you either in your Kennedy textbook or in this one read about beatniks and read about conformist culture, especially about the role of women in this? I can give you the exact pages if you want.
Okay.
And there are books on the shelf if you'll take it.
Beatniks and...
Let me find the exact pages because, whoa, look at old MacArthur. Didn't he look vampirish?
The moon landing was great. Bush's reptilian amazing.
Okay, I'm in page 984. 983 talks about the GI Bill of Rights. 984 talks about it also. Consumer culture, that was one of the questions,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, that was it.
That's page 1985. That runs to a 987. The Great Black Migration, 989, into northern cities. Conforming Culture, 991. Here's Jackie Robinson not being lynched, just stealing her this. And same picture. Same picture as from The Onion. Yeah. 991 is the Conforming Culture.
Being
benched. The Role of Women. This is really comes up a lot. The Attitude Towards Women in the 1950s, 992. Religious Revival, the Upsurge of Churches in America, 993, 994. And The Arts and the Beatnik Movements, 996 through 1000. But that chapter, that whole chapter there, which is chapter 31 of the Tyndall, is about social history of the 50s, and that does come up a lot. And to be honest, the book knows it more than I do.
Okay. So am I getting stopped?
Are you ready to stop?
So we need to copy off for you page 145 to 149. And once we finish this last page, we're done with the 50s and able to start into the 60s.